And now, Talk Radio 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with your hosts Richard Musio and Joe Vecchio. Now, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer. Tonight, we're being heard in San Diego County, Orange County, L.A. County, all the way up to Seattle. We have 50,000 watts of power out to the desert in Riverside County. We've got a terrific show for you tonight, so I'm going to talk even faster than I normally do. But it's now time to, it's time to introduce the main man of the hour and my co-host, CPA and family office guy, counselor, Richard Musio. Richard, good evening. How are you doing?
Good evening, Joe. Doing great.
That's excellent.
So you're going to talk faster than you normally do?
Well, I do. Actually, I try to talk slowly and distinctly as compared to other radio hosts out there in the world. But tonight we have such a special guest with a lot of information. So I'm going to talk rapidly, I think. Hey, before we get into the show, there's just one bit of trivia that I discovered this week because everyone's concerned about sustainability and green energy. And I found out that UCSD has a fuel cell, and it's the largest of any university in the country, I understand. And I found out that they produce about 85% of their own energy. So your investors and obviously where you put your investment dollar, this can be done, right, Richard?
Hey, I didn't know that. I mean, I knew it was a lot that they produced in-house.
Yeah, there's a
85%. That's very impressive. Way to go.
Yeah.
UCSD.
Yeah, it's terrific. But that's all I'm going to say because I want to get into tonight's show. And would you like to introduce the guest?
You can introduce the guest since you're talking so fast.
Okay. Well, you talk pretty fast too. But in any case, a couple of weeks ago at the Cannes Cinema, a very interesting film ran there for a week, and it was called Addiction Incorporated. And I talked about it a little bit last week, I believe. And the central character or figure in the film, the documentary, was a Dr. Victor DeNoble. And we are honored to have him in our studio here this evening. And not only that, he's a resident of San Diego County. So double honor for us. Good evening and welcome, Dr. DeNoble.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And not only that, before he got here tonight, he had pre-taped a C-SPAN episode, and he was on C-SPAN tonight from 5 to 6, and it'll be running tonight again at 8 and again at 3 in the morning and on. You can see it online probably in their archives. So that's terrific. And I did happen to watch that before the show.
So. That's good. From C-SPAN to our show. So he's moved up to the major leagues now.
Exactly. Yes.
But anyway, I saw this film the last night it was here, it just was a powerful film. It's a testament and a testimony to what's going on in the tobacco industry. But why don't we start at the beginning with your whole career, Victor, and how you your education and how you got involved with Philip Morris, et cetera. So from New York, right?
Yeah, from New York. And I was actually doing a postdoc fellowship at the University of Minnesota, and I was studying alcohol addiction. And I got a phone call from a guy named Bill Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up and he said, I work for Philip Morris. And he goes, and I have a job for you. And I said, well, what's a Philip Morris? I had no idea. He goes, oh, we make cigarettes. And I said, cigarettes? I said, dude, I do drug research, you know? And he goes, yeah. I said, you know, we got a problem. Maybe you can help us. I said, what's the problem? He said, well, the problem is, he goes, about 138,000 people will die every year because nicotine causes heart attacks and brain strokes. And I'm going, okay, you guys admit that? And he goes, he goes, we don't kill anybody, but nicotine does. He said, so we're trying to remove nicotine from tobacco. We want to get a drug in there that keeps people addicted, but won't kill them.
How nice.
Yeah, you don't like killing your customers because it's bad for, you know, the top line revenue.
Well, dead people don't buy cigarettes.
Right, exactly. Right. They don't buy anything.
So exactly. So I thought this was kind of an interesting opportunity, you know, and here it was, you know, 1980, and, you know, you could smoke anywhere in the country, and here's a company saying we want to help people and keep them alive, and I'm going, I can do this. So I actually joined Philip Morris on April 1st, April Fool's Day, 1980.
You know, your daughter, Richard, you've got your youngest is how old?
My youngest is 15.
She probably does not. I mean, people used to smoke in airplanes, in restaurants, and bars. But can you imagine smoking in a flying aluminum can? You know, you can't escape that. I mean,
I remember flying as a kid. In airports, sick. You couldn't even breathe.
Not to mention automobiles with your family members smoking. So, but the interesting thing is, Richard, you've never had a drop of caffeine or smoked a cigarette. Victor, you've never smoked a cigarette, correct?
That's right, but I can't say the same about caffeine.
Okay.
Yeah, I've never smoked a cigarette, never even tasted coffee. They've threatened to kick me out of the Italian race because I don't consume caffeine.
I supplement that by having a glass of wine every night, so I'm okay.
Do that either.
They're going to keep me in.
Yeah. So Philip Morris, they wanted to take the nicotine out and discover something just as or more addictive than nicotine. Was that the idea?
That's right. They had been working on a substitute for nicotine since about the mid-1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1980, 5 years later, they had all these molecules, but they didn't know what to do with them. You know, they said, you know, how do we find out if this is going to work? So that's my expertise. My job it was to find out if rats, their brains would like nicotine, like the substitute as well as nicotine, but their heart wouldn't get upset with it.
Kind of finding a sugar sweetener rather than sugar, find saccharin or something. But now there were 4,000 chemicals in tobacco, right?
Yes, when you burn tobacco or put spit tobacco in your mouth. Your mouth actually converts that to about 4,000 chemicals. Hmm. If you just look at tobacco, there's only 300 chemicals in there, but our body converts it. When you burn it, it converts it. So you inhale about 4,000 chemicals.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Interesting.
Joe, you were a smoker once, weren't you?
Yeah, I started like most kids, age 18 in college. We thought we were cool. You know, some of my family members smoked, and I didn't smoke until I got away to school. And boy, I tell you, you don't even think, you know, you're young, you don't even think of it as being addictive when you start. It's like fun, it's cool, you're adult now. And after about two and a half years, I said, I'm not going to buy a pack today. And then I realized, damn, that thing's like my sixth finger. I had to go out and buy another pack and every day, you know. And then it took me another 2.5 years of beating myself up to quit. And I actually figured out... Well, one thought occurred to me. I said, you know, this is like slow suicide. I said, the reason I keep smoking is because I don't have the huevos to put a gun to my head and pull the trigger, because I knew incrementally I was killing myself. And, you know, maybe that doesn't occur to most kids. And then I heard Victor on C-SPAN. He said a lot of people, you know, they quit several times over the course of life and they just finally give up and quit smoking. And, of course, then when you get older and sicker, they figure, what the hell, I'm not going to live anyway, and they keep smoking. And the saddest thing is when you see people. Now, I had my father got diagnosed and he smoked for 50 years and he was able to quit the next day. But you see some people who have already been diagnosed with emphysema or lung cancer, and they keep smoking because they're addicted and it's a futility for them. So, but anyway, so he gets in with Philip Morris and the story goes down the primrose path. And what happens next?
Well, we build the laboratory and we start looking at all these compounds. And around 1982, mid-82, we find a substitute, a drug that the rats said, you know, yeah, I like that. My heart's okay. And we actually propose a cigarette design for the company to remove nicotine, replace it with this other drug. You know, here we are. Yo, is it?
And the other drug is?
It was called a 2-prime methyl nicotine. It was actually a substitute nicotine molecule.
Wow.
Well, your brain likes it, your heart doesn't care. And, you know, everything was great for a number of years. And then around 1983, some lawsuits were filed against the tobacco industry. And for the first time in history, they were accused of marketing an addictive drug. And our lab is going, yeah, that's right. You know, we have all the data.
Right.
So the lawyers come down and they're going, you know, what are you guys doing? We're just doing our jobs. They said, no, you're not doing your job. You're doing the job of all these people who are going to sue us.
Mm-hmm.
So the company got really upset and they needed to suppress us. So mm-hmm. they suppressed our data. They wouldn't let us publish. They wouldn't let us present material. And on April 5th, 1984, they graciously said, you're fired.
At what point, now you went to this conference, this huge, was it a psychology conference? And
correct.
You were going to present. And who came up with the idea of, because they quashed you, and
right.
they said you can't present your findings that it's addictive. So you had how many other hundreds of people there presenting, other psychologists?
The American Psychological Association was in Los Angeles. And you're talking about, maybe somewhere between 35 and 50,000 scientists from around the world.
And they're all
we were supposed to present our material there, you know. Uh-huh. And it's called a poster board. It's like a big gigantic poster thing. You put your
exhibit.
And they said we couldn't present. So I was really angry. And I said, you know, I got to protest. So I went there and I stood, and you stand before your poster board for 4 hours. And I stood there before a blank poster board. There was nothing on the poster board.
And of course, you probably got more attention than anybody.
And again, people come in, like, what's going on? I can't tell you. The company will let me tell you. And, you know, it was like,
they let you even go. Did they?
No, we went on our own dime. We took off and we went, you know.
My God.
It was quite fun. So a lot of scientists told me that that's been sort of the highlight of their career.
Wow.
Coming to see the poster that was never there.
Wow. How do you like that, Richard?
Well, I guess it's one way to get attention. Who was chairman of the board back then for Philip Morris?
I believe back then it was chairman of the board was
Ross
Hauserman, was it?
Milhauser.
Millhauser.
Yeah, Ross Millhauser.
Because
didn't he make a famous quote about why he should risk $1 billion industry on rats' behavior or some strange comet?
Yes, actually, we were flown to New York. They wanted to justify our experiments, and we were flown to New York in this company jet, which was kind of cool because, you know, we're just these grunt scientists, and we get up there.
Oh, boy. Can we hold that thought because we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. Sorry.
That's okay.
Right, we are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs, and over to Richard to thank some of our sponsors.
Well, I want to thank our major sponsor right now. We'll thank some of the other sponsors later in the show, but UBS is our major sponsor. Thank you to Mr. Drew Freedies and Michael Quaranta for making all of this possible. Mm-hmm. UBS. And when we went to break, I found this quote. The chairman of the board of Philip Morris back in 82 was Ross Millhiser, and he asked this question. Why should I risk $1 billion industry on rats pressing a lever to get nicotine? Great question. And Victor was saying they were flying the company plane back east, and then we had to go to break. So, Victor, carry on.
Yeah, he asked that. There was only one question asked. We gave this like four.
That was the only question?
That was the only question. We gave
he didn't say, hi, how you doing?
Actually, I don't think he did.
He probably didn't.
No, he said goodbye.
You know, we gave this four-hour presentation about, you know, the work we were doing and all the stuff and all the potential. And he says, you know, why should I risk $1 billion industry and rats pressing levers for nicotine? And I looked at him, and the only thing I could think of it, I said, well, health. And he looked at me like I was some kind of idiot. You know? That was the purpose of our program.
Hey, in the movie, they showed in the boardroom tons of cigarettes, like unlit in bowls. Was it actually like that? Did they?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yes. In fact, when I worked at the Research Center in Richmond, you had seven stories, and there was a this is terrible to say this, there was a cigarette girl. That was her title, a cigarette girl. I mean, come on, can you believe it? And her job was to walk through the labs and give you a pack of cigarettes every single day, whether you smoked or not, and said thank you for working for Philip Morris. And twice a month, on the 15th at the end of the month, we got a carton of cigarettes. Paul and I used to get 70 packs of cigarettes every month.
Oh my God. Oh, my God.
You sell them on the secondary market. What do you do with 70 packs of cigarettes?
We built a castle in the one corner of the lab.
You know, speaking of cigarette girls, I've been out at some of the bars or lounges around town, and I don't see them anymore, but they actually had people out. Maybe I hope they stopped it, but they do have people. They sign you up on some kind of iPad, and they give you some kind of cigarettes, and I went up to the girl. I said, I think it was disgusting that, you know, you're trying to addict people like this. But
Joe, they still have cigarette girls in Las Vegas.
Vegas, yes.
Really? Absolutely. If you go to some of the casinos.
You know, but I'm talking San Diego County.
Yeah, I don't think they have them here, but the point is you still see them.
No, but this is a promotion by Marlboro or somebody or one of the brands, and I haven't seen them lately, but months ago I do remember seeing that. So I hope they've stopped, because you'd like to think California's, you know, we were one of the first states to ban it, right?
Absolutely. Yes. No question.
As a matter of fact, we had this discussion. I think Petco, part for ball games, you know, football and baseball here, I don't think we could smoke in the stands anymore.
No, absolutely not. You can't bring in chewing tobacco either. Victor, let me ask you a question, because it was just in the news last week. Tony Gwynn, one of the all-time greatest hitters in the history of baseball, Mr. Padre, had surgery, I guess a 14-hour procedure to remove a tumor. And this wasn't the first surgery that he's had.
Right.
I guess this was more serious, though, than the last go-around. And I think he started putting a pinch between his cheek and gum, as they say back in high school, which yes, something a lot of baseball players do. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he's actually fortunate because a lot of people who develop mouth cancer from spit tobacco actually die within the first 6 or 8 months. Mouth cancer is very, very aggressive. There's lots of lymph nodes there, lots of vasculature. So, you know, people who survive mouth cancer, they're very rare. You know, you see people who survive lung cancer. Mm-hmm. Survival means you last 5 years. But mouth cancer is very rare. It's a very aggressive form of cancer.
Huh. Wow. Well, I'm glad the surgeries went well for Mr. T. Gwynn. Absolutely. I just saw him out at the Steven Strasburg 5K raising funds for the Aztec baseball program back in, I guess it was the last weekend of January.
Well, let's hope he's back in managing the San Diego State team soon. So yes. We wish him the best. So you discovered this secondary type of nicotine, and they welcomed you as a hero because you developed a cigarette. And then tell them how it got into Marlboro's that way.
Well, what happened was, we were looking at the way rats were, getting addicted. And rats didn't like nicotine too much. It was okay. But then again, rats don't like alcohol that much either. So, I mean, you gotta weigh that. But why would so many people get addicted to tobacco? It's got to be something else. So we started looking into all the chemicals that went into a person's body. And like I said, there's 4,000. And one of those chemicals was called acetaldehyde. Now, I was familiar with acetaldehyde because it's implicated in alcohol addiction.
Okay.
And I said, gee, this isn't tobacco smoke. What is it doing in the brain? So we started looking into what it's doing into the brain of rats. And what it does is it actually goes into the rat brain and it mixes with another chemical that forms a chemical that looks like cocaine.
Huh.
So there's a second drug in tobacco that people haven't known about for quite some time.
Huh.
And by the way, our experiments were in 82 and 83, and it wasn't until 2004, right here at the University of San Diego, California, San Diego.
UCSD,
you mean? UCSD, mm-hmm. That James Belluzzi, a researcher there, found the same thing we found.
Huh.
And it was very exciting.
Eureka moment.
Yeah, the eureka moment for us because he discovered it again, which was fabulous.
Excellent.
So, Victor, question. I've never even tried a cigarette in my life. If I started trying cigarettes and smoked them regularly, would I become, dependent or addicted? What's the word?
Addicted. No question about it. In the beginning, addiction isn't something that happens to you. It's not an event. It doesn't happen today. Addiction is a process by which you slowly begin to change the way your brain works. With tobacco, it will take you about 6 months to about a year to get addicted to nicotine. But if you continue to experiment with that drug, any drug, cocaine, tobacco, I don't care what it is, continue to experiment. The usage will get heavier. You go from using to abusing to addiction. Addiction is the end result.
Wow. Well, we'll come back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs on this fascinating subject. Stay tuned. Thank you. All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs, and over to Richard to thank some more sponsors.
We want to thank, in addition to UBS, Rich Gaines and Family, Legacy Legal, Carl Sheeler and Business Valuations Limited, and the greatest CPA firm on the planet, Don Epic and Paul Polito, CPAs, up in lovely Vista, California, Polito Epic CPAs, great audit and review firm.
Outstanding.
And we were talking some trivia during the break, because Joe and I are working on a little project that has to do with the 40th anniversary of Title IX and the Battle of the Sexes between Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, the famous tennis match from 1973. But I was pointing out that when Billie Jean King and 8 other women professional players broke away from the women's tour, they were called the Original 9. They were sponsored by Virginia Slims, which, of course, was backed by Philip Morris. You've Come a Long Way, Baby. So the original sponsor of professional women's tennis in this country, which, of course, is booming now, but 40 years ago was just a fledgling enterprise, was Philip Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the slogan was, You've Come a Long Way, Baby,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think you could say these days and get away with that, at least not in my house.
And I, for one, am certainly glad that Marlboro signed in Qualcomm Stadium, formerly San Diego Jack Murphy Stadium. It was up there for years, and that's all you would see for many years. And I don't know when that came down, but I'm glad it is not there.
So we were going to talk about rats pushing pedals, but Joe, you mentioned it took you 5 years to...
Yeah, at the 2.5, when I was 18, 2.5 years into it, I was wrestling with quitting, and it took another 2.5 years of beating myself up daily, and I finally took up running, and I was running 30 minutes a day and finally, one morning I woke up and I just did not want a cigarette, and I have not had one ever since. So thank God for that.
Good for you. So Victor, I was quoting the former chairman of the board of Philip Morris, who said that he asked the one question, why should I risk a $1 billion industry on rats pushing a lever? Tell us about how many times rats would push levers.
Well, it's interesting. We trained the rats. The rats actually push a lever, and that's equivalent to like one cigarette.
But you had them wired into a hose into their brain or something?
Actually,
or?
It's into their vein.
Into their vein.
Like you're giving yourself, like a junkie.
Self-administration.
Yeah, so right into your vein.
Okay.
And now one cigarette sounds a lot for a rat, but it's really not. Rats are a little bit less sensitive than we are. So one cigarette for a rat is really like a third of a cigarette for a person. Hmm. And when the rats would press for nicotine, they would press it about 100 times.
A day, or I mean,
per day.
Per day, okay.
So it's about 30 cigarettes a day.
Are they awake all day, or
the rats are nocturnal, so they actually wake up and you know.
They sleep about 8 hours, like we do.
Like or? We do, yeah. The
okay.
same thing.
Okay.
So 100 times a day.
Yeah, and with acetaldehyde, the second drug we found, they would press it about maybe 180, 200 times per day. But when you mix the both of them together, they would press it 580 times. So it was one of these things where you know one and one is not two. This is now something where you've got these two drugs together that are okay, and when you put them together, they're unbelievably fast.
And you were the first one to discover that, or
that is correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you as a scientist are concerned about improving people's health. I'm assuming Philip Morris was concerned about how much money they could make.
Yeah.
Did this cause a rift?
Oh, sure. Around 1982, we were discovering the here the safe drug and here this more addictive drug and. You know, we're going, hey, you know, we can help people to save lives. And they're going, yeah, but we can addict a lot more people if we use this stuff. So, you know, by 83, we were at odds with each other. You know, they wouldn't let us publish. They suppressed us, our data. So we were really at opposite ends of the pole. And it was only a matter of time before we walked out or they fired us. And they pulled the trigger first, actually.
Did they ever make an offer to maybe ship you to Switzerland or someplace where there's no subpoena power?
Or try to buy you off, maybe?
Actually, both. moving us to Switzerland, Lausanne, Swiss, they had a secret lab in Lausanne. We were the secret lab, but the lab in Switzerland was the secret lab.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Dexter's laboratory, right?
That's true. His windows were all blacked out in Richmond. The only lab in there, right, that had blacked out windows?
Yeah, you couldn't look into our lab.
Right. No, okay. No, everybody else you could see through the window.
Oh, you could see right in there.
Okay.
So they actually made an offer to move you over to Lausanne?
Yes, they did. They wanted us to go to Lausanne and to continue to work. And we said, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, we live in this country. We're going to be here. And after we were fired, it was interesting, two lawyers came down to take Paul and I out to dinner. And these lawyers, I guess their name was, the first name was Rhonda and Jane, mm-hmm. You know, two lawyers came down.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically offered us a big chunk of money to keep our mouth shut.
Huh.
And my father, God bless him, he said, you know, Victor, if people will pay you to keep your silence, they'll hurt you to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful.
So back then, the attorneys for Philip Morris were Shook, Hardy, and Bacon.
Correct.
Shook, Hardy, and Bacon. Okay.
Kansas City.
Kansas City. Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
They were the attorneys for who? For
Philip Morris. Phillip
okay. Morris. They were the external attorneys
okay.
who came down.
Outside counsel.
Yeah, they came to our laboratory. They photocopied everything we wrote. They photocopied the books that we were reading. It was amazing.
So did you sign a non-disclosure when you were hired, after you were hired at all?
In the beginning, we signed it right when we were hired. We signed a secrecy agreement, which is not unusual. When you go to a corporation,
sure.
you sign
right.
it. The difference was is this agreement said that you could never in your entire lifetime work for another tobacco company or divulge what you've done there.
Wow.
So it wasn't, it was an unlimited.
They have
agreement.
To be reasonable within in terms of time and geography. So that sounds pretty heavy handed.
Yes, it was.
But you wound up testifying before Congress. Yes. Wouldn't that mean that they would have had to waive their legal rights with regard to your non-disclosure? Is that right?
And they did, yes.
They did, okay.
Yeah, if we went ahead and published, but presented our material without disclosure, the tobacco industry lawyers would have suppressed everything that we said.
Mm-hmm.
It was at a congressional hearing on April 14th, 1994, that the congressman, Sinar, was asking
the CEO,
Philip Morris, right. and said, listen, we've got this guy, you know, we're going to try to release him. Will you release him? And he said, no. He said, you know, yeah, but you know. The bottom line was we got released.
Yeah,
and
it's a big dramatic part of the movie. I think in the corporate counsel's behalf, I almost got the feeling he was sympathetic to or realized, hey, the gig is up or the jig is up and, you know, let Victor speak. I think he was almost sympathetic to the public movement, or he realized the public pressure against tobacco was so fervid or rabid that.
Well, what was interesting about that hearing, this was the first hearing that was ever televised on C-SPAN.
Really?
This was the first hearing. So here you have these seven tobacco
Waxman. Waxman had it, right?
Yeah, Waxman's
hearing. You mean C-SPAN was just going on the air with this?
That was the first hearing that was televised. Oh, and here you have the seven CEOs, and they're on national TV, and they're
and that room was packed with media.
But I remember watching that. They all said, no, they don't think nicotine is
addictive.
Well, they went under oath, too. They went under oath, which hasn't always been the case in past administration officials or hearings or things of that nature. So
you testified there because they let you out of your non-disclosure.
2 weeks later, after they testified, my associate, Dr. Paul Milley, and I testified in the same congressional hall, yes.
And we had this conversation, you know, the Waxman only had that committee for 2 years. Then, you know, the Gingrich Congress came in, and it's very likely that if they didn't have that window of opportunity, these hearings may never have taken place, correct?
This was a perfect storm. It really was. Yeah. It was just like the movie. You know, you had the Commissioner Kessler doing an investigation into tobacco. You had the tobacco executives. You had ABC News doing an investigation. And then you had us, Paul and I, coming forward. And it was this whole perfect storm that came together. Mm-hmm. Yes.
In fact, Joe, one of our previous guests, Bill Lirak, didn't he bring a large suit against, I think it was called Joe Camel?
Yeah, the Joe Camel suits. I think early on he was one of the main protagonists, so to speak.
Interesting.
So, and then in the Addiction Incorporated, the film, they get into the other legal cases. And, of course, the dam started to break. And you have to see the film to get all of that. But it was very, very interesting.
But there was the result was subsequently a huge, huge financial settlement, even though it wasn't immediate. I think it's paid out over 25 years. Yeah. How much money was it, Joe?
$206 billion.
$206 billion over 25 years. Yeah.
Wow.
But that's, if you look it up, I mean, it's divvied up many, many ways. I mean, it goes to almost all 50 states and different organizations. Everyone's got their hand in that pie. And over 25 years for the tobacco industry, it's not that bad a hit. And then the film brings up the point that Philip Morris or a lot of these stocks have increased anyway because they're into other junk foods and other things, right? They've diversified in other.
Yes. The tobacco industry has diversified significantly. You have Kraft Foods, you have Miller Brewing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you're right, $250 billion over 25 years.
206, I think.
206. It's an insignificant amount of money. I don't know the exact number, but I think it's $1 billion a day is what the tobacco industry sales are. So, I mean, in the long run, it was a win for them, definite win.
So $365 billion a year they're making. I mean, they can almost pay that off in a year if they had to.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Those are some big numbers.
Yes, they are.
I thought the Enron was a lot, you know, $7.2 billion. This is pretty significant.
So, Joe, quick question. Other things that young people smoke, clove cigarettes, marijuana, do they work the same way? In terms of addiction?
Well, as Victor.
Well, clove cigarettes don't do the same. They don't have an addictive drug in it. That's what's interesting. Clove cigarettes are pretty dangerous, though, because clove cigarettes, when you inhale it, it contains a thing called propylene glycol, which we all know is antifreeze. And people who smoke clove cigarettes will cough up blood every once in a while. And that's because the propylene glycol actually breaks those small little sacs in their lung called alveoli. And with marijuana, of course, there is an addictive drug in there, tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. And the numbers there are interesting. About 4 out of 10 people will get physically addicted to THC. Eight total will be psychologically addicted. So addiction is not only a chemical dependency in your brain, but it's also a psychological addiction as well.
But now in 2009, President Obama, and I guess this went through Congress as well, it's pretty bipartisan, so that's good, but the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, so that's now under the purview of the FDA, right?
Correct.
Tobacco? And
yes.
That was a huge monumental event, wasn't it?
It's a huge event, but you have to be careful because just because they are subject to regulation doesn't mean they're going to be regulated.
Right.
The regulatory authority takes years and years and years. There's lots of hearings. There's lots of public debate. And there's also legal challenges. I mean, right now in 2009, it was signed. And the first thing they wanted to do was have larger warning labels on tobacco.
Right.
That now has been challenged by the courts, by the tobacco industry, and they've won. They've actually won the case.
Yeah, they wanted 50% of the pack to be a warning, and
and the courts ruled that you can't force somebody to advertise against themselves in their own package.
Well, that's called regulation.
You have to be careful about that.
But and also, I think they've banned cloves. They're technically illegal, or they don't sell them commercially. But I don't know where your son's getting them, Richard. Did he probably get some?
Probably on the internet.
On the internet. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, my son's a musician, so he likes to smoke things.
Yeah. Well, you know, like Whitney Houston said, you know, her worst demon was herself. And I think Victor makes the point when he speaks at schools. He said, you know, your friends don't put the cigarette in your mouth and other things. You do it yourself.
So. I want to talk about what Victor's doing in schools when we come back.
We've got
to take a break. You've come a long way, baby. It's your money, not theirs.
Yeah, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Follow. All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs, and over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Again, big thanks to UBS for making this possible, Mr. Michael Quaranta with the La Jolla office. And we only have about 8 minutes to go, so we want to get right back to Victor. And Victor, I know you do a lot of presenting publicly, but a ton of it's in the schools, talking to young people. Kaiser has a program called Don't Buy the Lie, is that right?
Yes, Kaiser Don't Buy the Lie program started in Sacramento about 19 years ago. It's actually the best program in the entire country. It's been nationally recognized. And it's actually a billboard contest for tobacco education. And they have middle school students and high school students, and they develop these billboards. And each school has a winner. And then there's a grand prize winner. And that billboard gets put up all over Sacramento County, and it's seen by 800,000 people every single day. And 19 years ago when it started, we had, I think, 264 entries. And last year, we had somewhere around 15,000 or 16,000 entries into the program.
But you go into schools and actually show kids some really interesting things like monkey brains and...
Yes, I do. my program, it's called Inside the Dark Side, and I've been doing it now for 17 years. And I talk to about 300,000 elementary, middle, and high school students a year, and about 100,000 college students a year. My program is to go in there and talk to them about nicotine addiction from a rat's point of view. And why does a rat get addicted to nicotine? And it's simple. You know, rats don't have peer pressure. Rats don't want to lose weight. Rats don't go to the movies. It's because nicotine's a drug. It changes the way
you know. That's
works.
That's very enlightening right there when you think about it. Because
how do you know rats don't have peer pressure? I'm just kidding. Sorry.
We don't let them live together.
Okay.
I look fat in this wheel? But I'm sorry. This is serious stuff. Idea. I shouldn't be
you
joking.
You've been to an ABA convention? I mean, I don't know. Well, anyway.
Yeah, careful, Joe.
There's a lot
careful.
Of jokes. I know.
Careful.
I'm going to get myself in trouble.
So you actually show rat brains and monkey brains in school.
Yes, that's right.
And I would assume that gets kids' attention.
It certainly does. And, you know, the thing is rat brains have very much in common with our brains. Rats are smaller and not as smart, but their brain chemistry is very similar. So we can predict what's going to happen in a person by looking at a rat's brain or a monkey's brain. And it's important for young people to know that rats and monkeys get addicted to drugs without the social pressures. Those are the reasons that those are the explanations of why we use drugs. But the bottom line is it's your individual choice.
Now, that point wasn't even brought out in the movie that well. So I think that is a major, major important point because everyone thinks it's peer pressure. And I think the sad thing is, insidious thing is, a lot of this stuff starts out as social fun. And all of a sudden, over a short period of time, it's a private battle. And then you've got to deal with it from there. So,
well, the insidious thing is that people make huge profits off of people's addictions. That's really insidious.
Yeah,
but that's part of the price of living in a free country.
And we were talking about pot during the break too. And I don't think that should be given out at storefronts. I think if medical marijuana, you get a prescription, get it from your doctor, and get it at a drugstore like everything else. So.
Sure, I totally agree. I think you know medical marijuana is important, and there are uses for medical marijuana, but. If you're telling me you need to grow it in your backyard and sit on your front porch and smoke some marijuana because you have medical issues, well, I have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that going to getting a prescription from your doctor and getting a synthetic marijuana will help you. The problem is that if you're telling me you need to inhale marijuana smoke, which, by the way, contains the same 4,000 chemicals that tobacco inhales. You're telling me you need to inhale 4,000 chemicals
to make marijuana
have a
tea?
Medical benefit.
They need marijuana tea, I think. Green tea with marijuana. I don't know.
So, Victor, about 20% of high school students smoke. Is that right?
It's roughly? About 20% right now, and it varies from state to state. You know, California has one of the lowest rates. Florida has one of the lowest rates. Some of the other states have higher rates. So it varies from state to state, but you know, we're still seeing 20% of the population. And that's, by the way, what we mirror in the adult population as well, about 20% of the population smoke.
But in the schools you speak to, do they mirror 20% or do they do much better?
They do much better. Actually, there was some work done in Sacramento with Kaiser, and they actually went in and did some surveys with schools. The schools I went to, you know, 7 to 10 years earlier, and they found that the smoking rates were significantly lower, up in the 60s to 70% lower rate.
Excellent.
And how about other cultures? Do other cultures smoke as much as we do, or less or more? Major cultures, India, China, South America.
It's actually some cultures are much more, some cultures are less, but the bottom line is smoking is ubiquitous across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a number that's really frightening. In our country, about 400,000 people will die this year from tobacco smoke, from heart attacks and cancer. Worldwide, 6 million people will die this year because they use tobacco.
Wow.
That's an enormous figure when you think about it.
My friend thinks they're using it as population control in Asia. He might have a point.
And how dangerous is secondhand smoke?
Secondhand smoke is very dangerous. About 53,000 people will die this year, not because they smoke, but because they live with or work with a smoker. In fact, this is a very small room, radio station. If I lit up a cigarette in here right now, in about probably 30, 40 seconds, you'll both be inhaling 4,000 chemicals.
Wow.
Richard, I think it'd be a good idea, because Victor does speak all over the country and even locally, hopefully more so. But if people are interested in having him speak, Addiction Incorporated, all spelled out, .com. Go on that website, and there's contact information there, Addiction Incorporated, all spelled out, .com.
And when is the next C-SPAN show on?
Well, tonight at 8, right after our show, it'll be on again at 3 in the morning, our time. But you can actually go on the C-SPAN archives and see the hour interview he did with Brian Lamb there, and also the filmmaker, director, Charles Evans, who's got a pretty impressive uncle, I believe, right? Robert Evans, who did Chinatown.
The Godfather.
Godfather, yes.
And a slew of excellent films. He's 81. Have you met him, by the way?
Oh, I have, yes. And,
really?
And Charlie's father, yes.
Wow.
What a great family.
A whole family of filmmakers. So you couldn't have linked up with a better tradition there. So
Victor, we got about 1 minute. What are your final words, especially to younger people? I know it's hard for people in their 50s and 60s to change their behavior. But
I think with young people, the thing that is, the bottom line is it's your choice. It really is your choice. You might be 12 years old, 11 years old, but it is your choice. Understand, though, that what you do today, you may not see tomorrow. You may see 20 years from now. And that sounds like a long way off.
The slow suicide concept.
And again, it isn't whether you live or die with tobacco. It's the quality of the life that you're going to live. How are you going to feel when you're 50 and 60 and you can't go up and down stairs?
Right.
So it's a hard concept for young minds.
And typically, if you're a smoker, you're going to be unhealthy in all your food choices, your exercise choice. I mean, it's just going to be a very, probably not a very healthy life or a satisfying life. And it's too bad, because a lot of gifted, brilliant people fall prey to these things. And, you know, that's what the real shame of it is. But anyway, Victor, Dr. DeNoble, thank you so very much for being with us tonight. We wish you all the best. And addictionincorporated.com, all spelled out again. Richard Muzio, you have a great week. We'll see you next week, sir. And Dave Sniff, thank you. And thank you to Scott Love. And thank you to Craig Blanke, our personnel over here at KFMB. You have a great week, everybody.
Everybody have a great President's Day holiday, too.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Appreciate it. Good night.